From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, a national business writer tries to make sense of President Trump's very public battle with Harley-Davidson.
Here he's going to war against a company that has a lot of very, you know, high-paid, high-skilled jobs in the U.S. and threatening them with taxes or whatever he can, you know, a boycott. So that just threatens those very jobs that he's trying to protect. It makes no sense at all.
Then, why a play about Edwin Booth, a famous 19th century actor, speaks to us 150 years later.
The 19th century is more like us than unlike us. All of the same issues that we are exploring right now, we were exploring in the 1800s.
Radio Chipstone meets a Madison man and his collection of Oscar Mayer memorabilia.
And we'll have the latest ex-fabula. Lake Effect Weekend is next. News is first. Good afternoon. This is Lake Effect Weekend on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Harley-Davidson's 115th anniversary celebration runs throughout the Labor Day weekend, but as thousands of owners ride and celebrate, the Milwaukee-based company still finds itself in some controversial circumstances linked to the president's trade policy.
Harley-Davidson announced earlier this year that it would consolidate some operations in this country, shifting jobs from Kansas City to Pennsylvania, and they would also shift some production overseas as a result of President Trump's tariffs and his trade war with Europe. That triggered a backlash from the president, who called for people to boycott the company.
Bill Saporito has written about the president's beef with Harley. He is editor-at-large at Inc. magazine and a contributor to the New York Times editorial board, and he joined us by phone from New York. Welcome to the show.
My pleasure.
Do you think, is the current sort of quasi-war between the president and Harley-Davidson, is it a proxy for something larger in the president's trade policy?
Well, he just wants everyone to do what he says, and I don't think it's a proxy for anything, to tell you the truth. The president promised to bring manufacturing jobs to the U.S. and to keep those jobs that are here from going overseas. So what Harley's done is both close production facilities here and has said it's going to move some jobs overseas in response to the president's introduction of tariffs.
So the point here is that the president's introduction of tariffs and the president's desire for all jobs to exist in the U.S. seem like, if not mutually exclusive ideas, certainly at odds with each other.
Well, in this case, they are. I mean, here he's going to war against a company that has a lot of very, high-paid, high-skilled jobs in the U.S. and threatening them with taxes or whatever he can, a boycott. So that just threatens those very jobs that he's trying to protect. It makes no sense at all.
This, though, puts Harley in a pretty delicate balancing act, given that they seem to have no problem aligning themselves with Donald Trump and what he had to say early on in the campaign.
Well, of course, you're going to be for, most corporations are going to be for preserving jobs here if they can do that, and they're certainly not going to antagonize any president, whether it's Donald Trump or any other president. I mean, yeah, you want to play ball, but at a certain point, you have to run your business, and this is where the friction is occurring. It's occurring in the manufacturing side. It's occurring in the agriculture side, too.
It seems that Harley's whole reason for moving production overseas is to sell more bikes in other parts of the world. Is there any way, do you see any way for the company to survive or thrive without doing that?
It has to sell overseas, all right? Again, look at bike users. They tend to be younger, right, except in the U.S., of course. That's another story. But where are the markets for motorcycles? I mean, they're in India. They're in China. When you look at the way people progress in an economy, they start with bicycles, they move to motorcycles, and then they move on to cars. So if you're Harley, you want to catch that changeover that occurs in any developing economy.
Do you think there – I mean, you said you don't think there's necessarily – that this is a proxy for anything else, but I wonder if there's something larger for the country in Harley-Davidson's success or failure. Obviously, here in Milwaukee, there's a lot at stake.
Well, of course there is. I mean, there are jobs, right? And there's always this friction between labor here, and jobs there. You know, we're exporting our manufacturing base, which to some degree we have. So Harley has to deal with the issue of where is its growth coming from, right? If it doesn't get foreign growth, how can it fund its operations here? I mean, there's tension all over the place for Harley, and it's a bit unfortunate. But one thing is certain. They have to produce motorcycles in the places they're being bought in Thailand, in China, in India. That has to be done. Now, can you export? Yeah, you can absolutely export a certain amount of maybe higher-end bikes. But if you're going to produce motorcycles for the masses, they have to be more affordable. And the way to do that is to build somewhere else.
And I would imagine foreign markets are not something that most people have on their minds when they see somebody riding a Harley down, you know, Interstate 95.
No, but remember, Harley not only exports motorcycles, it exports its image. It exports this kind of American ideal, this ride-free, unencumbered. I mean, that's part of its marketing message, too. So there are two things that are being exported here. There's metal and there's marketing. You know, Trump hurts that when he lambasts the company. I mean, this is something that's important.
You write in your piece for the Times about this. Where does the decline in the power of unions come in this equation?
First of all, wages, all right? Unions help promote higher wages for workers because of their power, right? So, you know, we've been through a period of more than a decade now where wage growth on a real basis is flat. And I think that that's consistent with the decline of unions, the bargaining power that unions have. So, you know, and again, these are jobs. The jobs that Trump so wants to save are union jobs. Yet at the same time, his party, of course, has undermined unions whenever it can, and particularly at the state level and, you know, in Wisconsin. Again, this is one of the conflicts within Trump's policy, is that he wants to promote these jobs, yet at the same time, the party undermines them.
He wants it both ways.
Well, what politician doesn't? You know, I think this kind of nexus between manufacturing jobs and union jobs is where the real friction is. I mean, you can't, on one hand, promote manufacturing jobs in the U.S. and then on the other, try to undermine unions everywhere. I mean, that's going to be interesting, I think, in terms of the next, you know, the midterm elections and beyond that, of whether labor, the section of labor that went over to Trump, will come back or not. When they realize that this party is not their friend, will they then migrate back to their traditional Democratic position? It's going to be an interesting question.
I was trying to glean from your op-ed. Do you own a Harley?
No, I don't. I don't want to give anyone that impression.
Sure.
I'm just what I mentioned is that I'm part of the boomer generation that formed the core of their ridership, and which they now, you know, are trying to replace, which is, you know, a logical thing to do.
Right. That's the ultimate two big goals that Harley has are A, to expand in foreign markets, and B, to kind of replace this aging demographic with younger riders in this country.
Yes, and that's true of, you know, many companies and many industries. You need new customers, and if your boomer generation is fading into the sunset, then you've got to sell to the next one. Next generation, millennials, have not shown any great enthusiasm for motor vehicles in general. You know, this is the Uber generation. It's a tougher sell.
It's interesting to think about. You write about the scene where you know, the group that called itself Bikers for Trump rolled in to support the president in his rhetoric against Harley, and you wonder what kind of bikes these people were riding.
Well, I mean, they're core Harley riders, I'm sure. I didn't go take a poll, but, you know, that group are core to Harley, but again, they're older. There are some of them have moved on to the power trikes and demography taking its course. So Harley has now developed a plan to attract 2 million more younger, more diverse riders in the next couple of years, and that's very important to the company. And to have the president start to undermine it, it just doesn't help.
Do you see any, you know, ideal path for Harley through this period?
Well, I think, you know, all of this will. First of all, there's no evidence that, from what I've been reading, that Trump has been very effective in this kind of boycott call. There's, you know, again, it's early days, but don't know if that's going to work at all. I mean, Harley has a very attached audience, and I don't think they're going to give up their Harleys today.
Well, Bill Saporito, thank you so much for giving us some food for thought as Harley goes into its 115th celebration.
Thank you.
Bill Saporito is editor-at-large for Inc. and a contributor to the New York Times editorial board. You can find a link to his op-ed on President Trump's war with Harley-Davidson at WUWM.com.
The life of 19th century actor Edwin Booth, brother of another famous Booth, comes to life on stage this weekend in Milwaukee. We'll hear more about the production and the life of Booth when Lake Effect Weekend continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect Weekend continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Many Milwaukee theatergoers have had the pleasure of seeing Angela Iannone act on local stages over the years. She's a talented, passionate, and consummate artist, and she brings those same qualities to her playwriting. Theater Red's production of her play, This Prison Where I Live, is currently on stage at the Theater Space in the Big Red Church on 10th and Wisconsin.
This play is one of four that Iannone has written about the great American actor Edwin Booth. Booth was one of the greatest actors of the 19th century and was immensely popular. He was also the brother of the more infamous John Wilkes Booth. After the assassination of President Lincoln and the subsequent death of John, Edwin Booth spent the rest of his life haunted by his brother's actions, even as his own fame was undiminished.
I sat down recently with Iannone and actors Corey Jefferson Hagen, who plays John Wilkes, and Jared McDaris, who plays Edwin. Iannone began by explaining the true story that inspired This Prison Where I Live.
This play is about one specific moment in time that absolutely fascinated me, and it's absolutely a real thing. In 1879, April 23rd, as a matter of fact, Shakespeare's birthday, Edwin was performing his production of Richard II at the McVicker Theater in Chicago. And the McVicker was owned by his father-in-law. His second wife was Mary McVicker. So he is performing this production of Richard II, and he gets to the Act 5 of his cut of the play, which is Richard II after he has been imprisoned and is trying to figure out his life. And he's talking about, I have been studying how I may compare this prison where I live unto the world. And he's literally in a prison, but he's also in a prison of his own making because his downfall as a king has been partly his own fault. At the moment where he is sitting on the bench and speaking this monologue, this was a moment when Edwin, the actor, was very, very still on stage. And Edwin was famous and infamous, for once he had set the blocking or the stage business, he never changed it. No matter how many years he played the role, the blocking was the same. It worked. He was comfortable with it. He remembered it. He wasn't going to change it. So he's sitting there speaking this speech, and an assassin fires two shots from the right balcony. Now, in those days, the lights in the theater were kept full up, so the house lights are on. These bullets, either one of them, should have killed him. But for some reason, in the split second before that first bullet hit the stage, Edwin stood up, which he had never done in that role ever before. He stood up. The bullet actually whiffed his wig and lodged in the set wall behind him. Then, instead of running away or ducking or something, he walked downstage and looked out into the audience. The assassin fired a second bullet, which should have hit him, but it didn't. It went right past him and lodged in the stage floor. At that point, he pointed out into the audience, shouted, "Arrest that man." Three random guys in the audience that were sitting around this assassin wrestled him to the ground. A third shot was fired into the ceiling of the theater while they were trying to disarm him. They carried him out of the theater. Edwin Booth calmed the audience and said, "We're going to take a little break. We'll start again in 15 minutes. And he walked off stage. He would never talk about why he moved. He would never explain it. People said, what prompted you to move? Why did you stand up? What was happening for you?" And he would never talk about it. This play is about why Edwin moved.
So, my actors, talk a little bit about why Edwin moved without giving away too much.
It's okay.
Is it okay?
It is okay.
All right.
I think we can allow audiences to expect some things. I don't think we could give everything away even if we tried.
So by this point in time, John Wilkes has been dead for quite a while. So my appearance in this show is not exactly of this world. And so we get to play with the notion of Edwin Booth being a haunted man, which is a thing that's come up repeatedly in every Booth play that I've done with Angela through these years, all of her research. He was haunted, hung about with shades. So being able to play something or someone who is not there but is there has let a lot of this stuff that we don't have this information, so we can kind of expand upon it and go, well, maybe it's this thing. And this is, you know, what I'm doing is trying to steer him in the direction that he needs to go. Even though, am I there? Am I not? Who knows? I do.
You're not there, but you never leave.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a really important point
for Edwin.
For Edwin.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That Johnny has been dead for a long time, but Johnny's always there.
Yeah, that's a big thing in this play in particular is the constant presence. Edwin very much wants to be left alone, ostensibly to prepare or concentrate. But it's also worth pointing out that everyone who refuses to leave him alone is also challenging fairly deep underlying beliefs he has about how he needs to be behaving right now. And how he thinks he needs to be behaving right now is usually more based on his own misconceptions of what is right and wrong, or his own misconceptions on what is the society in which he lives dictates is right and wrong. I guess you could say decorum in some ways is dictating that. A lot of the play centers around these two estranged brothers, and obviously they have other things to argue about given why one of them is no longer around. But the arc of their conflict, I guess I'll say, both begins and ends with John Wilkes challenging Edwin's acting style, or at least what his acting style has become at this point.
So pulling all of this together, this is number four in the trilogy? Is that
there
right?
There are four plays.
Yeah.
This one was written second. It takes place in 1879, which chronologically puts it after The Seeds of Banquo, which Theater Red produced in 2015.
And which we talked about.
Which we did talk about. Mm-hmm. So chronologically, this one is third in the four produced plays, but I wrote it second in the progression through the four current Booth scripts.
I guess what I'm trying to get at with that is that we're getting this amazingly complete picture of who Edwin Booth mm-hmm. was mm-hmm. through these scripts and through these particular things, even if, like in this play, what happened, we don't know what actually happened.
We do.
But we don't know why.
Yes. This is my why.
And so why do we care about Edwin Booth still?
Well, I can give you my own thoughts about that.
And I want you guys to come in on
Absolutely.
That too.
Yeah. I am using Edwin Booth as a skin through which I explore social issues, issues of art, questions of identity, gender identity, racial equality. I'm slipping into that skin, and I am looking at the historical facts about his life and the people that he knew and finding ways to have conversations that interest me about all of those things. Because the 19th century is more like us than unlike us. All of the same issues that we are exploring right now, we were exploring in the 1800s, just in a slightly slower way of talking to each other about it because we didn't have the immediacy of social media. But Edwin Booth is alive at the time when photography is beginning, and he dies at the time that recording is beginning. So we are defining celebrity in America in brand new ways during his entire career. So the idea that a celebrity belongs to their public, the idea that people in the public eye should behave differently, might be held to different standards, might be tortured by that at the same time that that's their livelihood, so they can't walk away from it. Issues of gender. We have been doing cross-dressing in America since the late 1700s. And by 1825, there had already been a female Hamlet on the New York stage. But it was looked at with a lot of side eye. Like, what are these women doing? Why aren't they content with playing in skirts or playing roles that define their femininity in a certain way? Well, we were exploring those same things in the 19th century and beginning to say, no, I want to play some men's roles because the women's roles don't satisfy me. And people like Edwin Booth are taking roles away from women wearing pants and saying, I would rather have a man do it because it makes me more comfortable. And at the same time as he's casting male witches in Macbeth. So how is gender performed? How comfortable are we with things crossing over? He's operating in the 1800s, which is an uncomfortable time for American history in terms of performing race. So many fabulous social, political things happen. Edwin Booth is at the center of almost all of it. Art, poetry, politics, and defining ourselves as Americans because he was the first international classical star. He went over to England, and although they didn't like him much, the critics didn't like him, the audiences came and watched this American performing their Shakespeare. In a time when Americans are saying, well, we have every right to perform Shakespeare the way we want to, without an accent. He goes to Germany and is an enormous star performing in bilingual productions in Germany. He performed with the Italian tragedian Tommaso Salvini here in America. He performed all over the country, anywhere the railroad would go. And everyone connected with him. All of the women actor managers, all the women I've gotten to know that were an important part of American theatrical history that I was only able to find because of their connection with Edwin Booth, that because they were connected with him, somebody kept information, somebody kept a program, somebody wrote a bio, a critic showed up at a show. We should care about him because we can have conversations about things that were important to him are now still important to us. And looking through the lens of the past is sometimes easier because it puts it far enough away that we don't feel threatened and we're able to examine it in a slower way. And I think that the social strictures also help us, that there are manners and there are distances that you stand apart from people that you don't know, and there are ways that you treat the other gender that allow for surprising stage situations when those rules are broken. But when we see people in these clothes, we are expecting a certain kind of behavior. When that behavior is upset, we can spot that more easily.
Do either of you have anything to jump in on that with?
Oh, there was so much in there. I don't know what more I can add. I mean, besides the fact that Edwin Booth is interesting because he led us in the direction that we've moved in theater. We wouldn't have a dark house if it wasn't for Edwin Booth. You'd still have the lights up. There would be no distinction between the world that you're living in the play and the audience. So there are all these small things that we take for granted now that are thanks to him. So being able to look at all of this and go, okay, so yes, all of these things that Angela has just gone through, but also all of these small things that we think are so normal were not normal to him, but he made them normal. is incredibly interesting to me. And being able to go to her and be like, I have a question about this thing. And it doesn't matter where we're at. If it's in any way related to Edwin Booth, we can get her on a 30-minute to an hour-long tangent connected to literally everything and everyone he's ever worked with. And you walk out of it knowing more than you did before, and you're really pleased about it. Learning about Edwin and caring about Edwin just means that we're not giving up on the stuff that happened before. We're continuing to grow and expand upon it, and we're also learning about someone who is incredibly important in the world of theater and the world in general.
It's really talking about him as, a link to what was normal then versus what is normal now. And yeah, it is interesting, like you say, like Lights Out, for example, is normal now. But what I really appreciate is that like these revolutionary steps that he took were not necessarily considered normal for most of and sometimes the entirety of his career. Mm-hmm. And like the things that we consider revolutionary, like, you know, we're all raised on, I would just say Disney movies, for example, where like somebody causes some kind of revolution and then they become a celebrated hero like right away, usually in their early 20s or even teens. Whereas in reality, when you are, fighting for an artistic revolution of some kind, very often what you accomplish isn't appreciated until long after you're dead. It's gratifying, intriguing, exciting to play one of those people who like causes this artistic revolution, and then also the gratification from the outside of seeing the lack of appreciation that can receive during their own lifetime. In some respects, he was right. He was the first international superstar. So
yeah, Edwin retired from the stage after the unfortunate incident in D.C. and he was gone from the stage for 8 months. During that time, most of his family was placed under arrest. Edwin was the only one with the name of Booth that was not arrested. And it was only because he was Edwin Booth and everyone loved him and revered him. And it's like, no, we know he, of all of the family, had nothing to do with this because most of the family was under arrest for suspicion of conspiracy in the assassination. But he went into seclusion. He went into hiding. He would only go out at night, and he would only go out even at night surrounded by a group of his friends because they feared that someone was going to kill him. And he did receive death threats for the rest of his natural life, that everywhere he went, there would usually be a letter waiting at the theater, or they would arrive at his hotel and he would open them and it would be a death threat. And sometimes there would be letters to the editor in newspapers saying Edwin Booth had better not appear on stage because if he does, there will be trouble. And how dare he? How dare he perform? So he was in seclusion for 8 months. And when he finally came back, in 1866, he opened with Hamlet, which was his most beloved role and the one that people really wanted to see him in. And he was afraid that it wasn't going to work, that they were going to boo him from the stage. But according to the accounts, there was a 5-minute ovation when the curtain came up and discovers the character of Hamlet on stage during the coronation, waiting for the king and queen to enter. There was a 5-minute ovation, which at first he thought was booing, but they were applauding, and it went on, according to people who were there, for 5 minutes. And he never acknowledged applause from the house, but according to the stories, he looked up, and they could see that his eyes were filled with tears, and he nodded his head and then dropped his gaze again and waited for the play to continue, and then never looked back, you know, continued to perform. But no one was allowed to speak his brother's name in his presence. And if someone did, tried to ask a question or involve him in a conversation, he would abruptly leave the room and that person would never be allowed anywhere near him ever again. It was a burden that he continually carried.
And which we will see played out in some way.
Yes.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Because you can't bring Johnny on stage and not have both the audience and all the characters on stage aware. This play takes place in 1879, and Johnny died in 1865. So there's a whole long history of just carrying that big, big vault of silence around with you, the things we do not speak.
Angela Iannone is an actor and playwright. Her play, This Prison Where I Live, is currently on stage in the theater space in the Big Red Church on 10th and Wisconsin. It's produced by Milwaukee's Theater Red. Jared McDaris plays Edwin Booth and Corey Jefferson Hagen plays John Wilkes Booth. There is more information about the show at WUWM.com.
Coming up next, Radio Chipstone introduces us to Madison resident Matt Treadaway and his collection of Oscar Mayer memorabilia. Lake Effect Weekend returns with that in just a moment on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect Weekend continues now. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. After operating for nearly 100 years on the east side of Madison, the Oscar Mayer plant closed its doors just over a year ago. Matt Treadaway grew up in the shadow of that plant. He didn't follow in his father's footsteps and become an employee, but he did inherit his dad's love for all things related to the bologna with a famous first name.
It's a Sunday afternoon when contributor Jennifer Fields catches up with Treadaway, who's showing his collection in the basement of a church. He has rare objects like the uniform worn by famous Wisconsinite Meinhard Rabe, who was the first Little Oscar spokesperson for Oscar Mayer. But mostly Treadaway is surrounded by all kinds of Wienermobiles, small whistles made of plastic, child-sized pedalmobiles, and even plush ones perfect for cuddling.
It started 19 years ago. You know, my fiance at that time, you know, she kind of talked me into, I hate to say it, but disability. Because my feet, and I'm diabetic. I've had 42 surgeries. I used to be a workaholic. And I thought, what am I going to do if I go on disability? I had panic attacks. And so she showed me how to get on eBay. You know, and I started selling Christmas CDs on eBay. And somehow I came across an Oscar Mayer site. And I bought some whistles. And that kind of started the bite into collecting.
I don't know why. I guess because you're surrounded by this Oscar Mayer stuff. Mm-hmm. I thought you at one point maybe worked for Oscar Mayer, but this is outside of that.
My dad worked there for 28 years. I have his retirement folder over there. But I've never worked there, but every time we drive by, I just had a love for that building.
Could part of it be a nostalgia and a connection to your father? When you look at these items, do you hear stories that he may have told you or just even recounting his day at work?
Mm-hmm. You know, he keeps saying over and over and over how the Oscar Mayer family would just, they would go through the plant and talk to the employees, and they were very family-oriented. And he just appreciated that, you know, they treated him very well. They treated a lot of people very well. You know, behind the plant, they put in a baseball field for the families to play baseball with the kids. And, you know, I just can't say enough for them.
So then, is that part of your collecting? Because I look over here, and I don't see that you have one electronic Wienermobile. You have several. You have several large cars. It's one thing to collect an item because it has a nostalgic pull to it, but why so many?
I can never get enough. One item that I'm very proud of is over in that corner. That is the very first building that they built back in 1890. Well, that they kept adding on to that, and that became the Chicago plant. Over on that table there is a brick from the Chicago plant. And then that big white brick, that's from the Madison plant. I met the son of one of the two families who had purchased the property of Oscar Mayer, and I worked out a deal, and that to me is a dream come true. So I wanted a brick from Chicago and one from Madison.
So it's not that it's the single thing that brings you joy. It's all the things that bring you joy. So is this, this is a pretty good, how many items do we have here? Like, ballpark it for me.
That's a pretty good question.
200 maybe?
Yeah, that'd be a good guess.
So then is this your entire collection?
No, this doesn't even scratch the surface. I have a 10 by 20 storage unit that I have most of it in. aside from the basement of where I live.
Is this a collection or an obsession? Are you crossing a line here with this?
It started out as a collection. But, you know, I've done talks of the history of Oscar Mayer, and now it's obsession. What I'm looking for now are the real rare items. Something that I don't have in the collection. I have hundreds of Wienermobiles that you just see everywhere. But I would, you know, like those, the two bricks, those are rare. It's not exactly what somebody else would have. Mainhart Robbie, his uniform, I have the certificate of authenticity of that with his personal signature. How many people have a certificate of authenticity with his signature on it? That's a prized possession for me.
So now, how did you come across that prized possession?
You know how rock bands have groupies? I have my own Oscar Mayer groupies, and to this day, I have no idea who called me. But they gave a heads up of a gentleman that I knew. His whole family knew me. He had passed away, and that's how I came across that.
This is a serious subculture.
Yeah.
Has it gained more traction since the plant closed?
I think it has. It's almost like a lot of people yesterday was telling me it's like a reunion. The old employees come in and they see each other and they sit down and they get talking and reminiscing. And I just love listening to that or talking to them.
So you're a collector of objects and the narratives. You want both.
Yeah. Because that's talking to somebody who actually worked at the plant or for the company. That's how I learn a lot about the history, aside from research or what have you. Down in the basement of where I live, I have quite a few items. That I just, this sounds weird, but I just, you know, my computer's down there, and every now and then I'll just turn around and look at what I've got, and I just, I love it. I'm in awe of what I have. I guess words can't reveal my love for the family. Yesterday, one of the family members came here, and I was in such awe that I met that person. That made my day. That made my year, to actually meet a Mayer from the family.
So, how close in proximity do you live to the plant?
Half a mile. When I turned 18, I got married, and I couldn't wait to move as far away from my parents as possible. I made it to Middleton.
Were you driving a Wienermobile? Is that what held you back?
I would love to have a Wienermobile.
Have you ever contacted them and asked if you could drive?
No.
Is that just too much for you, Matt?
Yes. I would love to ride in one, but I wouldn't drive it. I'd be too uptight.
Material culture contributor Jonifer Fields curates the Radio Chipstone series. The project is funded by the Chipstone Foundation, a decorative arts foundation whose mission is preserving and interpreting their collection, as well as stimulating research and education in the decorative arts.
This week, Jonifer spoke with Matt Treadaway of Madison. We will take one last break and then have our storytelling series, Ex Fabula. Lake Effect Weekend returns right after this on Milwaukee's NPR.
Three. Two, one.
Welcome to Ex Fabula!
True personal stories.
Ex Fabula!
Ex Fabula is a Milwaukee nonprofit committed to strengthening community bonds through the art of storytelling.
Ex Fabula Radio Time on 89.7 WUWM during Lake Effect Weekend. Every weekend, I'm Bruce Winter. Leah Delaney, Ex Fabula co-founder, is here as per usual. And every week we have a theme based on stories taken from Ex Fabula Story Slams of the past. And I'm just guessing maybe we got something about motorcycles? No.
No, we're on the Labor Day Express train this this weekend for stories.
No surprise, Bruce is wrong again.
That's okay. Maybe next year.
Maybe next time.
Yep. The theme this week is all in a day's work.
That
you
fits.
Better work, yes. Bruce.
Yes, that fits.
Yes. So we just want to say hats off to all the union workers and those who have helped create safe working conditions that we all know and love mm-hmm. today. So we do have a couple of fantastic stories from one of our fantastic themed Fantastic Story Slams. The theme of that Story Slam in November 2017 was work. Mm. But before we jump into that, we will be talking about our Season 10 Story Slams that are coming up momentarily. So if that's not a teaser, I don't know what is.
After this story, folks.
After this story, folks. So let's jump right in. Here's Karen Nelson with her work story.
It was 1994. I worked in the ER as a nurse. A little bit after lunch, a woman came frazzled up to the desk saying, "Help, help, I need some help. My uncle is very weak. I can't get him out of the car." So Terry, another nurse, and I grabbed a cart. We went out to the parking lot, reached in the car on the passenger side over the slumped over uncle who really wasn't weak. He appeared to be dead. So slid that over. We superhuman strength lifted him onto the cart, his arms open wide like Christ, and he took a gasp. We went racing into the break room. We went to the big room, the trauma room we called. We have a code four, everybody. The team kind of came running in. I was in charge of the airway. Terry was putting him on the monitor. This is 1994, so the first priority is open the airway, give two breaths. I was trying to get the AMBU bag off the wall. We thought, well, maybe he's not dead. He took this giant gasp. I felt no breathing. I was trying to grab the AMBU bag. It would not come off the wall. So in the old days, you would pinch the nose and blow two breaths into the mouth. On my second breath, there was my neon green gum on his tongue. I'm like, oh, my God. And Terry's like, what? I'm like, gum. She's like, was he chewing gum? I'm like, no. She's like, well, he's got gum in his mouth. I'm like, yes, it's mine. She's like, well, take it out and continue CPR. So on and on it goes. He was asystole. We went through, gave the epi, yada, 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 yada. You know, the guy didn't make it. He was very old, and asystole is not a good sign. He was actually very sick. So the shift goes on. The person comes in. They got that look. I've got a tampon in that's been in there for days, so dealt with that. A person with chest pain. Towards the end of the shift, someone from sterile processing came up and says, hey, was that guy chewing gum? And at that time, I'm chewing gum again, and I'm thinking, I'm from a big family. I waste nothing. I know that gum still had flavor. Did I put it back in my mouth? I'm like, oh, my God. And I'm like, and Terry says, well, he had gum in his mouth, but it wasn't his. And the doctor looks and says, how did he have gum in his mouth? And she's like, Karen dropped her gum in his mouth. He's like, you idiot. No, he didn't really say you idiot, but his whole bald head got red, and he bent over, and then I was like, is he going to yell at me because he's kind of an idiot? And then he laughed hysterically. But anyway, so the gum's out, yada. Oh, and I'm like thinking, did I put the gum back in my mouth? Because I know it still had flavor. I just put it in before the code began. And I said, why? And he said, well, there was gum on the endotracheal tube. I'm like, oh, thank God it wasn't mine. So from the early 90s, things have changed where CPR, you don't emphasize blowing in their mouth as much. And I think I have part of that. So thank you very much.
And that was Karen Nelson.
You know, I couldn't help but laugh dropping her gum in the patient's throat. But those people that work in the emergency rooms and hospitals around this city, man, I admire them so much because they deal with everything from kidney stones to gunshot wounds on a daily basis, man.
And those EMTs, man, serious hats off to you. Man. I know the pay is not that great, and your dedication, I mean, thank you.
Mm-hmm. And I have been, you know, in the emergency room a few times in my life, and, you know, those people do a fantastic job.
Yeah,
thank
you. Yes. Thank you to everybody.
So, as we teased,
let me bring the surprise out to you. Our surprise is that we're back again for season 10.
That's no surprise.
Yeah, I know. Well, oh, thank you. We're actually flattered if you say that. We have a whole litany of new story slams coming at you and special projects and special ex-fabula, secret fabula sessions and storytelling workshops and all that. So we have a story slam coming up. It's on September 14th. It's a Friday night. That's right, folks. We are having slams on Friday nights now. Look at us.
Yes, better than Monday night or Tuesday night.
Hey, man, we're doing it all week. We want to make sure that it is as inclusive as possible. So on Friday, September 14th, the theme is Generations, and that'll be at our favorite Garfield's 502, which was just featured on Milwaukee.com as a hidden gem. And my goodness, yes, get to it. Fabulous food, people, yum.
If you haven't been there, here's a good excuse.
Yeah, right? And then we also have a general public storytelling workshop that's going to happen on Saturday, September 9th at Collectivo on Humboldt. So let's move right into our second and last story of the day. Here's one from Weston Meyer and his work story.
So I need to start off with an apology. I've lied to you all. I've come up here under false pretenses. This is not a story about work. Hold on. This is a story about school, but that's as close as I've gotten, so give me a break here. Plus, the last 2 years of medical school really are work, with one minor exception. You don't get paid. You're, in fact, paying. but in the first 2 years of medical school are, like college plus. It's more lectures, more tests, more books. It's everything that an insufferable type A perfectionist is already used to. But at the beginning of your third year of medical school, you get thrown into a hospital, and it is sink or swim. It's fake it till you make it, it is a frightening time, and it is a magical time, because that is when you find out what you really want to do as a doctor. Everyone comes into medical school saying, "I'm going to be a cardiologist. I'm going to be a neurologist," but it's not until you get into your third and fourth years, your rotations, and you see the reality of it, and that's what sells it to you. So many people do a complete 180 once they really see what the life is like. So it's a very formative time. But one of the ways in that it's most formative is not necessarily figuring out what you want to do, but figuring out what you don't want to do. And I knew from the start that I didn't want to do surgery. But you have to take a surgery rotation. So I signed up for it first. My very first rotation, day one, I'm in the operating room. A little frightening. It was terrifying. It was 8 weeks of constant terror. I was fortunate enough that I ended up working my surgery rotation at the Children's Hospital Wisconsin. And there's something magical working about kids. I still didn't like the surgery, but it was cool enough because it was all novel, everything's new, and the kids were just so cute, right? And so one day I'm working my very first overnight shift. I'm going to be there until 11 the next morning. I'm overnight with my resident, and in the middle of the night, in comes this darling 7-year-old girl. And she is, doubled over in pain. And she is just not feeling well. So my resident and I, we get called down to the emergency room to see her, to evaluate her for maybe it's appendicitis, right? So we go down, and, we talk to her. We get the history, right? And we call up, our attending, who is a woman about half my size and terrifies me to this day. It is incredibly smart. And we call her down and we say, we give her the story and we're like, we don't think it's appendicitis. And she says, whoa, wait. She comes in with pain here, She's not eating. She's throwing up. She has a fever, and her white blood cell count is elevated. And you're telling me she doesn't have appendicitis? And then my resident and I kind of look at each other, and I go, well, when you put it that way. So sheepishly, we end up taking her to the operating room that night. And you'll be happy to know that they don't let the medical students operate. But I did get to pilot the laparoscopic camera used, you know, to see inside for the laparoscopic surgeries. And so I got to, you know, take this girl's history in the emergency room. I, you know, contributed, I like to think, to the surgery. I got to take pictures that I showed her later. I stole an EKG from a very reluctant emergency room physician when she passed out later, and I wanted to make sure her heart was okay. And 2 days later, I'm working during the day, and she's going to go home. She had her surgery. It went great. She is 100% better. And so I go into the room to tell her the good news. Like, you can go home now. And this little girl who has, like, been healthy her entire life and then just went through, like, probably the most traumatic 2 days of, like, pain and fear and surgery, she comes up to me, hugs me around the legs, looks up with these, like, big deer eyes, and then turns back to her parents and says, can't we stay one more day? That's when I decided on pediatrics. Thanks.
And that was Monsieur Weston Meyer with his story.
That is such a cute
touching
story.
That
the reason why he chose pediatrics. You just want to go, oh, what
right.
It's done.
Right. And that's what we want to do. We want to give everybody a good hug after they leave a story slam. So with that being said, everything story related is at exfabula.org. But get your tickets in advance for our very first story slam of season 10. It is Generations. Get that story together, Milwaukee. Get your tickets online and get thee to thine Garfield's 502. I think I messed that up somehow, but you get my
joke. Close enough. Can you tell she's a bit excited, folks, about the next season coming up? Just a little bit. If you want to hear today's stories again, or maybe share them with others, look at the pictures of the storytellers. You will find that at WUWM.com. And until next week.
Until next week, sir.
Boom.
Exfabula is a regular feature on Lake Effect Weekend, and it wraps up another edition of the show. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie Noor. Thank you so much for making us a part of your afternoon. Lake Effect Weekend airs every Saturday and Sunday from 3 to 4, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Keep listening. All Things Considered is next. It's 4 o'clock.